From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On this edition of Fresh Air, the past and present of bad taste. John Waters has written and directed a new comedy called Serial Mom. We'll talk with him about his new film. We'll also bring you a 1985 interview with him. Also from our archives, an interview with the man who played the leading lady in most of Waters' films, Divine. I spoke with Divine just a few weeks before his death in March of 1988. Also today, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews the debut album by singer-songwriter Beck. His song, Loser, is a hit on the radio and MTV. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. The Associated Press is quoting administration officials who say Serbian forces have captured all key points in Garajda. United Nations peacekeepers are reportedly pulling back from the Bosnian city's outskirts. There are about 10 observers still in the city. NATO carried out airstrikes against Bosnian Serb positions earlier this week in Garajda to protect the UN observers there. The bodies of victims from two U.S. helicopters accidentally shot down in Iraq are being flown to Germany for identification. NPR's Dieter Berger reports from Frankfurt.
After the accident, the bodies of the 15 American and 11 foreign victims were taken to a U.S. airbase in eastern Turkey. Later today, they will be flown to Rhein-Main Air Base in Frankfurt. Identification of the victims will be made at a U.S. Army mortuary in Frankfurt. Information on the identities are being withheld until next of kin are notified. After the identification, the remains will be flown to destinations specified by family members. The helicopters were stationed at a U.S. Army 5th Corps Aviation Brigade based in Giebelstadt, Germany. The investigation into the crash is being led by the European Command Board. I'm Dieter Bergen, Frankfurt.
Belgium says it has advised the UN Security Council to suspend its mission to Rwanda. This word came as the last Belgian troops departed the country. The BBC's Mark Doyle reports from Kigali, Rwanda.
Belgian officers stood in the turrets of white UN armored cars as their convoy of heavily loaded vehicles made its way to the airport for evacuation. As they drove through the broken city, past looted shops and decomposing bodies, government troops and rebels exchanged sporadic automatic and mortar fire. The withdrawal of the Belgians from the UN mission following the violent killing of 10 of their comrades by government forces has left what a senior officer from another UN contingent described as a vacuum. 600 Ghanaian troops previously stationed in the north of Rwanda are being pulled back to the capital to take the Belgian positions. The contingent from Ghana had been policing a UN buffer zone between rebel and government forces.
Mark Doyle reporting. The confessed killer of Martin Luther King has won a judge's permission to call witnesses and show evidence in court to try to prove his innocence. James Earl Ray has been trying to take back his guilty plea and go to trial since shortly after admitting murdering King in 1968. His request for a trial has been rejected, but Ray's lawyers will be able to question witnesses and put on other courtroom evidence in an attempt to prepare an appeal of that rejection. The process will not overturn his conviction or free him from his 99-year prison term. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials are up 2.5 points at 3,665. In over-the-counter trading, the Nasdaq is up a point. This is NPR. Chicago postal officials have found more piles of undelivered mail. They discovered 2,000 pieces behind the home of a fired letter carrier, and they found some 3,000 pieces in another carrier's car trunk. Some of the mail was 7 years old. Officials have turned up nearly 70,000 pieces of undelivered mail in Chicago since the beginning of the year. The Postmaster General says the performance of the Chicago Post Office is unacceptable. Postal surveys rate Chicago customer satisfaction at below 70%. Strong thunderstorms have poured up to 1.5 inches of rain in parts of the Midwest. Missouri has taken the heaviest blow, but the rain moved through the state so quickly that weather forecasters say it will have little effect on the rivers. NPR's Kathy Lohr reports.
The Mississippi and Missouri rivers in the St. Louis area have crested or are near crest today, but storms that move through the area overnight worry people living along the rivers that have reached far out of their banks. Regional hydrologist with the National Weather Service, Lee Larson, says residents don't need to worry about this storm.
Well, I don't think that's going to aggravate the flooding that we already have. The heavier rain was a little bit further north up in the Iowa area where they had up to an inch and a half. But again, that shouldn't compound the flooding problems in the Missouri and the St. Louis area.
The worst flooding was in Valley Park, just southwest of St. Louis on the Merrimack River, where 1,000 people had to leave their homes. The Merrimack crested last night at nearly 21.5 feet above flood stage. I'm Kathy Lohr in St. Louis.
Authorities in Chattanooga, Tennessee, say violent weather has killed a second person today. Emergency officials say a man has been found dead under his home after a series of twisters struck southeastern Tennessee. One person died earlier today near Elizabethtown, Kentucky, when a storm blew over her mobile home. Bowling Green, Kentucky, reported damage today when tornadoes hit that city. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. John Waters' new movie, Serial Mom, just opened. So today we're presenting old and new interviews with Waters, plus a 1988 interview with his late leading lady, Divine. John Waters is proud to make movies in bad taste. His cult film, Pink Flamingos, was billed as an exercise in bad taste. The story involved two couples vying for the title of the filthiest people alive. All of Waters' early super low-budget films had a self-imposed X rating. His recent films have gotten him out of the midnight movie circuit into the multiplexes. His biggest hit was Hairspray, about a chubby teen who becomes the star of a TV dance show. Serial Mom is a comedy about a perfect housewife who kills neighbors whose imperfections irritate her. John Waters has always been fascinated by the criminal mind. When I spoke with him in 1985, he'd been teaching in a Maryland prison.
It basically grew out of my fascination with going to murder trials. It was the next logical step. That I basically, there's something in me where I need the company of murderers about once a week. Because it really fascinates me. And I'm not saying I approve of murder or anything like that. It's the one thing I like to be figure out why people do things. I mean, I've always been interested in abnormal psychology, all that kind of thing. And so I knew a person that taught there as a living, and he brought me in as a guest teacher a few times, and I showed my films. And I really wanted to get a job there. I thought it would be interesting, and it was, of course, irony to get a paycheck from the state of Maryland to rehabilitate people by showing them my films. I thought was rather strange. So I went to talk to the warden, who was a woman who was belied the big bird cage and that kind of female prison warden. And she was at first concerned I wanted to make like a documentary exposing the prison. I think this is a good prison. I mean, they're under psychiatric care. They have to keep up or they're put back in the bad prisons. So that's how it started. And I showed them all my films. My book, Shock Value, was required reading. I think it's the only college in the country that had my book as a textbook. And I got a lot out of it, and they got a lot out of it, I think. I don't think I was bad for them. I told them, look, everybody wants to murder somebody every once in a while, but don't do it. Draw it. Write a story about it. I said, these films are my crimes, only I get paid for it. And at first, they were kind of bewildered to hear that. But I don't think that's bad advice.
You've actually, in your films, I mean, they're comedies, yeah, but they are a lot about people who are desperate or who are criminals,
yeah,
who are performing really taboo or criminal, yeah, acts. What was it like for you to meet the real thing, to meet people who really were psychopaths or really are murderers and,
yeah,
rapists?
The difference is that they are much more normal. They look like a college class in any community, I think. They do not look, what's the expression,
banality of evil.
Yes,
yeah.
That is the thing that impressed me the most. That was very difficult to connect the faces of some of these people who I like, genuinely liked as people, to the horror that they must have caused other people. But once they're in prison, they're very different from maybe how they were when they committed their crimes. I would say half of all the people I had were always Vietnam veterans, which was many of them, Angel Dust was involved. Those were the two most common denominators of the people I had. This prison, though, is not for career criminals. It's people that are emotionally disturbed but not legally insane. So maybe most of them had no record and then one day killed three people. Or, I mean, the stories were amazing. But I told them I wouldn't exploit them. And in my article in American Film about it, I don't tell anything of what happened to them. Because I thought that would be unfair. I mean, to go in, and they confided in me and told me all. I was like, in a way, a therapist, only I had no say if they got out or not, which their therapist did. It was a very interesting experience for me. I mean, but there was humor always involved, and we talked a lot about that. In the most desperate, horrible situations, you can still laugh. And I don't mean laugh at what you did, but see the humor in these horrible situations. I mean, I went to the graduation where they wore caps and gowns and afterwards went back to a life sentence. What could that feel like?
There's a lot of people who believe in a lot of sociologists who say that showing violent movies encourages people to be violent, and that showing movies about crime might encourage people to commit them.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think about that, having worked with
prison? You'd be surprised at the films they show in prison. I mean, they show sometimes hardcore pornography, which shocked me. We talked about that. We had a whole class about that. I don't think my films are what they mean because they're comedies, but we're talking about things like maybe the Texas Chainsaw Massacre or something like that. And some of them said that some of the people that were really violent psychopaths would watch them the same way someone would watch pornography, to be turned on by them. And that is a question there's no answer to. I agree. But if you – then nobody can see those movies because one person reacts like that. I don't think that's fair either. I mean, he can get turned on by that from turning on television too. These people, some of them, when they saw the films, they acted just like my parents. They were very straight. They would say, why would you make a movie like that? But in the same way, I think they figured, if I could make a living doing this on the streets, there was hope for all of them, I think, in the long run.
Whoever would have thought that your films would be used in a therapeutic, rehabilitative context?
Well, in a way, you think of it, the Pink Flamingos, if that can freak out society's outlaws, where that humor was more dangerous to them than the hideous things they did with guns and everything, that they could freak out people that did that maybe isn't bad, because they realized that you could use something like that to be antisocial, but it's not going to hurt anybody.
So do you see yourself as socially redeeming now?
Only in jail, in a weird kind of way. That I didn't go in there for that reason, but I don't think I was bad for them in the long run.
Was it depressing to spend a lot of time?
No, it was not at all depressing to me. If I had to do it every day, I thought about that. If I went in there every day and that was my job, maybe. This was once a week. I look forward to it. I miss it. You know, I went back last week as a substitute teacher.
Did you ever think that if you turned out differently that you might have been in prison?
No, that's the whole reason the whole thing obsesses me, is because I could have been in there. I think that there was certainly a possibility that in my life I could have ended up in jail if I didn't have an outlet for the rage that the films gave me. Because everybody needs that outlet, and they didn't have one. And I think rage is certainly healthy. I don't think it's bad. And everybody has it, or else they're pretty dull. People that have no rage, I think, are usually milquetoast personalities.
Two of the people who you've worked with a lot are Divine, who's a really big man who plays the leading lady in all your movies, and the late Edie Massey.
Yeah.
Did it ever seem like the joke was on them, especially on Edie, who
I know.
Here's what I'm asking: that they're both really heavy, and in your movies would appear in really revealing clothes that would accentuate every fold in the flesh that would hang over their stomachs and thighs and rears, and you could interpret it as kind of making fun of their size.
I don't think I was. I really like people that society has branded as outsiders who turn what they're discriminate against into a militant style. And that's why the whole image of Divine came up. A person that is fat does not usually wear skin-tight cocktail dresses. With Edie, only in one movie was she dressed really like that, in Female Trouble, in her black leather suit. Edie, I think you could always tell in the films I liked her. You know, and I did like Edie. I never thought I was making fun of Edie. I think Edie was a very gifted comedian in her own wacky kind of way. I don't think anybody could imitate her. I think she was like nobody else. She had a delivery that was like nobody else, and she had a voice like nobody else. Edith certainly was made to look grotesque sometimes, yes. But I think that you liked her still. I don't think that you were laughing at her. I hope not.
So you see it as different than, say, Fellini's use of grotesques in his movies?
I think Fellini loves his grotesques too, though. Have you seen this book, Fellini Faces? It's just all the people that have sent him resumes through the years, and it's unbelievable. I think he respects those people. I certainly do. I think that I don't want to look like that, I'll be honest. But, you know, Divine just lost 92 pounds. I'm so afraid he's going to end up real skinny, and we'll have to make the Karen Carpenter story. That'll be the only movie we can make.
John Waters recorded in 1985. John Waters' new movie is called Serial Mom. We'll feature an interview with the late Divine after this break. This is Fresh Air. The only sad thing about the opening of a new John Waters film is that Divine can't be in it. Divine died in 1988 of a heart attack. Divine was frequently referred to as a 300-pound drag queen, but he preferred to think of himself as a character actor. It was Waters' movie Pink Flamingos that first made Divine famous. If you've seen the film, then you'll remember the image of Divine's huge frame covered in a skin-tight, low-cut gown. Divine's last film with Waters was Hairspray. I spoke with Divine in February 1988 when Hairspray was released. It was the month before Divine's death. We talk first about his role in Hairspray. The film was set in 1962. Ricky Lake played Tracy Turnblad, a hefty teen who upstages the reigning teen queen on the local TV dance show. Divine played Tracy's mom, Edna Turnblad. In this scene, Divine is taking her daughter to Mr. Pinky's hefty hideaway house of fashion for the ample woman to buy some new clothes for the TV dance show.
Mr. Pinky, I'm Tracy's business manager, Edna Turnblad.
Well, it's a pleasure to meet the both of you. Here we cater to the big bone gals like yourself who are stylish and at the same time frustrated by the lack of sizes in the department stores today. I saw you on TV. I want you to be my model.
Would she be paid for this?
One free outfit a month. You start tomorrow. I hope there's no diets in the works because I want to design your Miss Otto Show coronation gown myself.
Could you throw in a pair of complimentary petty pants in the deal?
You drive a hard bargain, Miss Edna, and rightfully so. Petty pants, panty girdle, you just let Tracy take her pick.
It's a deal. Thank you, Mr. Pinky.
I'm going to make you a star.
Let me ask you to describe in your own words the two roles that you play in Hairspray.
I think one is Edna Turnblad is a loving mother and adoring wife, and vice versa. And she has a child that wants to break into a dance program on television. At first, she's a bit leery, but then realizes that, in her words, she could be one of the Rockettes. So she thinks this is great and gets behind her 100% and becomes her agent and manager. Then I also play a part of an Arvin Hodgepile, who is a racist, sexist pig, and he owns a television studio. And he's just a hideous person. So it was great to play, because they're unlike any other characters I've ever done.
Are you glad that you played a dual role, that you played a female and a male role, so that you're seen as a character actor who's capable of performing in both roles?
Definitely. I think it's the cliche Hollywood story of being typecast, and I'm definitely a victim of that. But I think I'm very lucky that I'm starting to come out of it. It's taken 20-some years. Like I said, I'm screaming at people, I'm not a transvestite, I'm not a drag queen, I'm a character actor. I never set out in the beginning of my career just to play female roles. But fortunately, or unfortunately for me, they were the only things that were offered to me. They were written for me, which is unbelievable to have that done. And they were the leads of the movies. So you don't go around turning down parts that are the leads or that are written for you if you're a young actor. I had no idea, though, that they would be such strong characters that people thought that was all I could do.
Let's talk about your roles in Hairspray. A part of the movie is about hairdos, about the great teased bouffant hairdos of the early 60s. And I know John Waters is really enamored with those old hairdos. You used to be a hairdresser, didn't you?
Well, for a very short time. I'm glad I had that experience. It's come in very helpful now. Because when I'm on the road and things during my club act, there aren't always hairdressers available or things. So I end up having to do it myself. And I said, I'm glad I know how to tease, because that's definitely the look they want. But I said to John, he doesn't have to go too far from his front door, actually, to still see women that look just like that. When I was doing the film, it was very funny, because the first day on the set, I walked down the street. No one looked at me twice. I walked right through the camera crew, past John, and kept going, and none of them looked at me. I came back and stood right in front of John. He looked at me, and he did a double take. It was very funny. He said, I can't believe that's perfect. So I looked just like one of the girls on the street.
How did that make you feel?
Oh, it was good. I mean, that was the best compliment. I mean, I did fit right in. I did look exactly the way I was supposed to. And because so often with my size and things, I'm so, not uptight, but about sticking out too much.
Self-conscious?
You know? Yeah, self-conscious. Yeah, about sticking out too much or being the largest person on the set. But then in a way, that's the best thing too, I guess. You'd noticed more.
I'm just going to ask you one question about the famous Pink Flamingo scene in which the movie ends, and just one question about it, and then you have to eat a fresh dog turd, and you and John Waters have both said that you did it to kind of get attention, and the film really did. I mean, you were real upcoming people.
Well, John came to me and he said, well, you know, would you do this? I said, oh, sure. I thought he was kidding. And a year later, he said, okay, now tomorrow you have to eat the dog turd. I thought, oh, this is great. He wasn't kidding, you know. And he said, well, listen, do you want to be famous or do you want to be completely forgotten about? He said, it's going to do either one or the other for you. It's going to make you or forget. You said, your name will go down in movie history forever anyway, no matter what you do. And I thought, well, what do I care? You know, I was very young and you don't think about all these things. And I didn't really think about it until I had to follow that dog around for 3 hours. And finally it went and... It was quite a hideous experience, actually.
Well, here's my question. Did you rush off to an emergency room afterwards?
Well, no, I went home.
That's a silly question, but I'd be wondering about, you know, germs and things like that.
Well, I had mouthwash and things, and I brushed my teeth and goggled. Anyway, I went home, and I was sitting there. And the more I thought about it, then I started to worry. So I called the hospital, and I'll never forget this. And I didn't know what to tell them, you know, because I was a bit old running around eating dog feces. You know? So I called and I said, oh, hello, this is Mrs. Johnson and my son just ate dog duty. And what should I do? And she said, well, how old is your son? And I said, well, he's, you know, 24 years old. And well, then the nurse got, she said, some maniac's on the phone here. Her son's 24 and he's eating dogs. So... I got back on the phone. She said, well, why? And I had to tell her, well, I said that he was retarded and that we had a dog and he was in the backyard playing with the dog. The dog had gone to the bathroom and he'd eaten the dog mess, you know. So she said, well, you just have to wash his mouth out and, you know, do all this. She said, but feel his stomach every day because he could get what was called the, you know, like a worm, a white worm. And every day I was feeling my stomach to see if it was. Finally, one day it got hard, and I thought, oh, my God, I've got it. But I had hysterical white worms as it was. I didn't have anything. So I was very lucky. But she suggested that I get rid of the dog.
Well, I know John Waters wants to do a sequel. You wouldn't go through that again for a sequel, would you?
No. I said, do I have to stand under an elephant the next time? Forget it. I said, I had to draw the line somewhere. So I said that was my last experience with animals, please.
Actor Divine is my guest. Did you love movies when you were growing up? What were some of your favorite films?
Oh, I've always had a very macho taste in movies. my favorites then when I was a kid were those Knights of the Round Table movies and war movies. And,
really?
Yeah. I still like a good war movie. I mean, Platoon and all those movies I loved. And I really do like Rambo movies and Sylvester Stallone. And Charles Bronson, I think, is probably my favorite.
So you probably really enjoy playing heavies when you get the chance to do that.
Yeah, yeah. I like to play in some of those movies, you know, where they kill 150 people in the first 2 minutes of film. It really does relieve, you know, any frustrations you might have, I think.
That's great. So you liked really war movies and action films. Did you like glamour movies when you were growing up?
Well, anything that Elizabeth Taylor was in, I liked.
Did you like her better when she was thin or heavy?
It didn't matter to me.
Uh-huh.
Didn't matter. I thought it was just more of her to look at when she got heavy. But still very beautiful. And I finally did meet her one day, and I couldn't speak at all. After years of planning what I was going to say to her, I was... Blah, 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 blah. I don't drink, but I went and had a double scotch and came back and had a little conversation with her.
Did she know you?
She knew of me. It was a party for her daughter, Maria, and her hairdresser and makeup man, a man, were people that I've used. And they had told her all about me, so she wanted to meet me at the party.
That's great that you'd use the same makeup man.
Yeah. We look a lot alike.
You know, John Waters has said that he really has always loved it when people who don't fit mainstream good looks take what they have and really turn it into style, turn it into, you know, an advantage. Did you feel like you were doing that when you were growing up? Because you were, I think you were always pretty heavy.
Yeah, well, no, actually not, because I was very much an introvert, and I never really went out of the house till I was about 16 years old. I was very uptight about my weight and about the way I looked, and always wanted to look like everyone else. And finally, my junior year, like when I was 16 and in high school, is when I really started hanging out with John and everyone else that I got the confidence together to to go out, and I was always in a coat. I always had a raincoat on or something. People probably thought I was a flasher, but I was just just uptight about, you know, how fat I was. But at the same time, couldn't or wouldn't do anything about it. Finally, I went on a diet, like I said, my junior year, and lost to 80 pounds and went down to 145 and for my senior year. And then I was able to get dates and go to the prom and everything. But still, it was strange to me because all of a sudden people talked to me. They wouldn't talk to me when I was fat. And I thought, well, what's this all about? You know, it was a rude awakening, actually, at a very young age.
How did the tough guys in the school treat you, the people who really wore the hoods?
Oh, well, I wasn't. They used to wait for me every day to beat me up after school. And to the point where I was quite black and blue and afraid to say anything because they had threatened my life. And it was very bad. And finally, one day, I had to go for a physical to the doctor, and when I disrobed, I mean, it was quite obvious that something terrible was happening to me. And finally, I broke down after a lot of questioning and told him what the problem was. And they called my parents, and when they saw what I looked like, they were quite hysterical. And we had the police at the school, and the kids were expelled. And it was quite an ugly situation, which made me even more unpopular with their friends and the other people, you know. But so I had to go through, like I said, the next 2 years of school with that stigma attached to me. But then I think finally, like I said, in my senior year, it was more or less all right. It wasn't so bad. But up until then, it was quite hideous, and I really hated school, and I hated the whole situation.
You said that it was John Waters who gave, you know, who helped give you your image.
Right.
How did you decide on what that image was going to be when you first were getting
well,
it together?
Well, at the time, there were Andy Warhol, and a lot of people were making cult movies, and as they called them, underground films then, which were just the equivalent of your independently made movies today, low budget. And so the one name, like Viva, was very popular, so John gave me the name Divine. He just said he thought I was, and it was that I was funny and that I was divine, and it was a good name for me. And also because we had a very heavy Catholic upbringing, we had sort of religious names. So I don't know. Of course, the names became more popular again today with Madonna and Cher and Prince and Princess and all of these people. But did I go off the subject?
No. And then when you were getting like this, well, excuse me.
I couldn't remember what the question was.
Oh, about forming the image when.
Yeah, so the thing was John wanted a very large woman because, as you had said before, he wanted the exact opposite of what normally would be beautiful. He wanted a 300-pound beauty as opposed to a 110-pound beauty. He wanted, as I've been called, inflated Jane Mansfield. that's what he got. And also, it's ironic that he would say the most beautiful woman in the world turns out to be a man. So everything there is backwards. So it's really a John Waters character.
My interview with Divine was recorded in February of 1988. Divine died the following month at the age of 42. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air, a new interview with John Waters coming up in the second part of our show.
It's Madison time. Hit it. You're looking good. A big strong line. When I say hit it, I want you to go two up and two back with a big strong turn and back to the Madison.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, we build on our bad taste theme with a new interview with John Waters. We'll talk to him about his new film, Serial Mom, about a perfect mother turned serial killer. It stars Kathleen Turner. Waters says casting a movie star is the only way he has left to shock his audience. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Mellow Gold, the debut album by pop bohemian Beck. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Reuters News Service is quoting UN sources who say Bosnian Serb forces have advanced to within 500 yards of the Garajda main hospital. The Serbs have reportedly taken all key positions within the city. The Yugoslav news agency says the Serbs are urging the Muslim troops within the city to surrender. They've also called on Serbian and Muslim citizens to take shelter behind Serbian lines. President Clinton has met with senior national security and foreign policy advisers to discuss the downing of two U.S. helicopters yesterday in northern Iraq, NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
The Pentagon has ordered a one-day stand-down of all U.S. flights over Iraq as military authorities review safety procedures and continue to investigate what went wrong yesterday. Defense officials say that only AWACS electronic reconnaissance planes will still operate in the region. Defense Secretary James Perry said it will take weeks for military investigators to figure out how the American warplanes could have mistaken the U.S. helicopters for Iraqi Hind helicopters. The White House is also reacting to criticism from House Minority Whip Newt Gingrich, who said that the tragedy over Iraq and the airstrikes in Gazda are putting too much strain on a thin military budget. White House spokeswoman Dee Dee Myers said Gingrich and other critics are trying to use an incident like that for political advantage. She called the remarks inappropriate and unacceptable. I'm Richard Gonzalez at the White House.
The Israeli army has urged Israelis near the border with Lebanon to take shelter following guerrilla rocket attacks. NPR's Paul Miller reports.
The rockets, apparently fired from Lebanon, landed harmlessly in northern Israel. A few hours later, people living in the largest town near the border, Kiryat Shmona, were told to move to shelters as a precaution. Israeli military commanders blamed Hezbollah for the rockets and said Israel would not permit an escalation of attacks on its northern territory. The Israeli army is also rounding up supporters of Hamas, the Palestinian extremist group, which claimed responsibility for two suicide bombings inside Israel in the past 10 days. Palestinian sources said more than 70 Hamas supporters had been picked up in Gaza and the West Bank. Palestinians are upset about the arrest, which they consider to be collective punishment. I'm Paul Miller in Jerusalem.
Ministers from 124 nations have adopted the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade. The GATT is the world's biggest trade agreement. It took 7 years of long and often heated negotiations to adopt the document. It's intended to boost the world economy by lowering trade barriers. More than $200 billion is expected to be generated over the next 10 years. Wall Street finished the week mixed. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell almost 2 points today to close at 3,661. Declining issues led advances by a slim margin in very heavy trading. This is NPR News. South Korea has dropped its demand that it and North Korea exchange diplomats. The decision is part of an effort to resolve growing tension on the Korean Peninsula over the North's suspected nuclear weapons program. The North has resisted the demand. That, in turn, has blocked high-level talks between the United States and North Korea. The North wants to improve its relations with the U.S., but it doesn't want to swap envoys with Seoul, saying the South has no right to interfere in the nuclear dispute. Both the U.S. and South Korea are trying to get the North to open its nuclear plants to full inspection. Chicago's O'Hare International Airport continues to be America's busiest passenger airport. Melba Gomez of member station WBEZ reports.
The Airports Council International says O'Hare handled over 65 million passengers last year, an increase of 1% from the year before. O'Hare also had the largest number of flights, with over 859,000 takeoffs and landings in 1993. That's an increase of 2.2%. Second on the list was Dallas-Fort Worth, with 49.1 million passengers and over 803,000 flights. Airports in Los Angeles and Atlanta were the third and fourth busiest in the country. Memphis International led the nation in cargo handling by processing nearly 1.5 million metric tons. Memphis is the home of Federal Express. For National Public Radio, I'm Melba Gomez in Chicago.
A new study finds that most black Americans don't believe racial equality will be achieved in their lifetime. University of Chicago professor Michael Dawson says another 23% don't think it will ever happen at all. Dawson questioned 1,200 blacks about racial attitudes in the United States. He says the survey indicates a more radical black America than existed even 5 years ago. He says this is particularly true amongst younger and poorer blacks. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. John Waters has a new comedy called Serial Mom, which gave us the occasion to record a new interview with him. John Waters used to cast outrageous misfits in his films. His new film stars a genuine movie star, Kathleen Turner. She plays the perfect suburban housewife and mother, so perfect that other people's imperfections are unacceptable. If neighbors don't recycle or floss their teeth, the only solution is to kill them. The film struck me as a send-up of made-for-TV true crime films. Like all the films in that genre, it starts with the words, "based on a true story," which of course it isn't. And like so many movies in that genre, it ends in the courtroom.
Well, you know, I've never even hardly seen any of those movies. The only ones I watched were, I didn't watch the TV movies. I watched more like In Cold Blood, The Boston Strangler, The Executioner Song. I think that's kind of the more highbrow ones that I was trying to make fun of.
Uh-huh.
And the very fact that I've read so many true crime books, I have a huge library of them. And that's really the genre that I based all my knowledge on, because I don't watch too many of the TV movies. I know they make them, and I know the American public is familiar with them, and that's enough. I don't have to watch them.
The serial killer, the serial mom in your movie, goes on trial and, of course, becomes a celebrity serial killer. Now, this is actually a phenomenon that you've both watched and participated in, because you've gone to a lot of, celebrity murder trials yourself.
Yes, I started out with that. I think I've gone to less and less of them, and that always happens to me. When one of my obsessions finally becomes the theme of a movie, I almost use it up. Like, I've never been back to an amusement park since we did Hairspray. I've never, I started buying new music again after I made Crybaby. I think it's sort of, you spend, like in Hammerjacks is a club we shot in here, a great rock and roll club in Baltimore. Well, after spending a week into it and listening to the same song every day, it's sort of, you go beyond that. I'm not saying I wouldn't go to another trial again. I certainly would. But I'm more of a snob about it now. It really has to be an A-list murder to get my interest. And there's so much lowbrow crime happening lately with Tanya Harding, just an ice skater, something I have no interest in. The Bobbitt case, I thought they were both kind of low class, but not in a great way. I thought the crime was kind of boring. It was a paperback book, no hardbacks about that one.
So what are some of the celebrated murder trials you've gone to and felt you really got something out of?
Well, certainly Patricia Hearst was the last great one. I wish I had been to the Leopold and Loeb case, or the Lindbergh baby case is one I'm sorry I missed.
Are there a lot of groupies at these trials, and do you talk to them?
Yeah, I used to. You know, I think Court TV, in a way, has made the whole country a groupie of
That's
trials.
That's a good point, yeah.
And they've upstaged me. You know, it's not as much fun now to say, oh, especially the Mendez trial, which was very hard to get in. There was only 3 seats to the public. Now, if you went to a dinner party and said, I was at the Mendez trial, people say, yeah, I saw it on Court TV today. It doesn't have quite the punch it used to have.
Well, you know what I think? That has also kind of upstaged you, in a way.
What?
You know, your interest with really, you're in like really trashy people, like in Pink Flamingos, everybody fought over the title of the filthiest person alive.
Right.
Now you turn on talk shows during the day, and all these crazy people are on there who are just like talking about how they've been incested, or about how their mother abused them, or they didn't invite their mother to the wedding.
That's what,
or what's that?
I saw one that where the woman said, "Mother, you have BO," and said it right in front, and the woman started crying. You know, that's where dysfunction has become fame.
I know, but it's like as if the characters from Pink Flamingos were now the guests on talk shows, but completely without irony.
No, you see, the Babs Johnson and the trailer residents of Pink Flamingos would never have gone on those talk shows. They might have raided them and killed the guests, but they would never... ever. They have friends to talk to. That's what I think sad about the shows, basically, is that don't you have friends to tell your mother has BO to? You know, why do you have to go on and tell total strangers? I feel bad for them. I can't watch them too much except Ricky Lake, which of course I watch because of my personal connection to her. But that even seems like parody to me. When Ricky says, "Stay tuned for Obesity at 5 with Ricky Lake," it's just like she's doing the Hefty Hideaway ad in Hairspray.
I know you've been fascinated by violence since you were very young.
Let's clarify that. I have been interested in the fame of violence. I am the opposite of a violent person.
Right.
I only saw the Rodney King tape once. I would never look at it again. I turned my head away. People have sent me violent news, real things. I never, ever look at it. I hate real violence, and I love fake violence, just like the character in the movie, the son of Serial Mom. And when they finally see real violence, they realize the difference.
Right. So what's how you'd think that somebody who just really hated true violence would be put off by screen violence too?
One's make believe. I mean, mm-hmm. like Blood Feast to me is that's entertainment when they rip out her tongue. I have no problem. The funniest thing somebody said to me, one of the woman crew members said to me very seriously after we showed Blood Feast in the movie, she said, "I hate it when guys rip out my tongue," which really made me laugh. I thought it was a great comment. She said it real casually too, and it did. I love people that can make me do a double take, and that one certainly did. See, I have no problems with that, but I would never want to watch a snuff movie or any kind of real violence because I know one is fake. I know one is set up and is a total lie to get a reaction or to entertain me. I don't have problems with that because I know it's not real, but I don't want to see anyone really suffer at all.
My guest is writer and director John Waters. His new comedy is called Serial Mom. More after this break. This is Fresh Air. John Waters is my guest, and he wrote and directed the new movie, Serial Mom. In the press kit for Serial Mom, you're quoted as saying that you're fascinated by people's secret lives, and you believe that everybody has one. And you say, "I think it's because everyone has a darker side that keeps society functioning. Everyone knows that the other person is basically crazy."
Yes.
"And it's this fear that keeps everybody from not acting out all their lunacy."
Yes, I believe that. That every day everyone could slaughter every person they meet. There's certainly the possibility of that. So basically, since we all fear that about the other person, we suppress that, and that is what's called society and order.
So did you have a secret life as a kid? Or was it the secret life pretty public?
My secret life, certainly I'm media wise enough not to share with Fresh Air. But however, I think that I've had certainly a wonderful outlet for any kind of secret thoughts that I've ever had is being able to make these movies. I think the popularity of my movies, what popularity I've had, comes from the fact that basically I'm not embarrassed to do comedy about subject matters that most people never have the nerve to joke about and only secretly make jokes about to themselves or their very close friends.
If you believe everybody has a secret life, do you think your parents have had secret lives?
Certainly I do, and I think everybody wonders, you know, are my parents real people or are they just my parents? I think my parents, if they have a secret life, I don't know it, and I'm not so sure I would want to know it. Would you want to know your parents' secret life if they have one? People in the studio here are saying yes. I'm not so sure I would.
I don't know.
It depends what their secrets were.
That's true. You have often had eccentrics playing normal people, or your version of normal people, mm-hmm. like having Divine playing the mother in Hairspray.
He ended his career playing a very normal person and began it playing a homicidal maniac, which I think is a good stretch.
Yeah, and in Hairspray you had Deborah Harry playing a parent in Sonny Bono. But in the new movie, the parents are kind of straight Hollywood actors. you know, yes. Sam Waterston, and
they're only how
Kathleen
else could,
Turner.
How else could I surprise you in any way? But yet to have already established movie stars making a John Waters movie, that was the only way to cast this movie that would be different, that would be a little bit startling to the public.
This is the only way you can think of to be subversive now?
Yes. Is to have Sam Waterston from The Killing Fields to Serial Mom to Abe Lincoln in Illinois. Is sort of, you wouldn't expect that, I think.
In the opening credits to your film, Kathleen Turner gets her first taste for death by swatting a fly.
Right.
And the splatter dead fly is the image on the screen as your name comes up in the credits.
Well, I wanted to get the audience right used to it right from the beginning. Here we are, the heavy-handed direction of John Waters. I thought it was the first joke in the movie, really.
Uh-huh.
To basically, I love credit sequences. I spend a lot of time on them. Alan Rose has done my credits from Pink Flamingos on. And it was in the script from the very beginning, is basically to let my audience know that I was back where I belonged in R-rated material.
Now, the fly splatters and it's nice and kind of...
It's fake. Did you see at the very end of the movie, at the very last credit, is no flies were injured in the making of this film.
Oh, I miss that. That's
And the
funny.
Reason I had to do that is because when we were making Crybaby, there's a scene where somebody shoots a gopher and they don't really shoot it, but they send the SPCA to your set, I guess, to see you aren't like an animal slaughterer. And I said to the woman, suppose I wanted to kill a fly in a movie. And she said, I couldn't let you. She said, I know it sounds ludicrous, but I could not let you do it. So that's what gave me the idea of even doing it in the first place, of course, because she told me I couldn't. And how we had to do that was freeze the fly with this kind of look, and then it comes back to life after about 30 seconds after you freeze it, and then you shoot it in reverse. And that's how we got the shots of it landing on the butter. It was like a National Geographic shoot. And I thought, how great. Here's like 10... grown men making high pay to make sure that this fly isn't squashed to death and no fly is injured. It was fun.
Same way
of getting the rat to bite the woman. That was late at night. Teamsters are waiting for us. We have this fake leg with this damn rat. No, bite the leg. It was a fake leg. We put peanut butter on it. That's what rats love, you know. Peanut butter is their caviar.
So you had to create fake fly splatter juice.
Fly gore, I think, would be the correct thing. And it was done by Brooke Yatton, who is Tracy Lord's husband and my best friend's son, who has grown up making vomit and snot and all different things from my movie. He has a history of it, really.
Uh-huh. Now, there's two songs, two very kind of optimistic, upbeat songs, more or less. You know, Barry Manilow's Daybreak and Tomorrow from Annie.
And there's certainly Gas Chamber by L7. That's upbeat to some people.
Yeah.
That's our moon glow. That's how I figure the theme from Picnic.
When you negotiated to buy rights for the Barry Manilow song and to the song from Annie, did they know the context you were going to use?
They always have to know the context. Barry Manilow had absolutely no problem with it. Annie, I think, had big problems. It was very, very expensive to get the song. They held it hostage, I think. But I'm very happy that they even let us do it at all. And it all goes to my producer, John Feeder, who I think knew Ray Stark, who had some connection. And John used to work with Ray Stark. And that's how I think we finally got them to let us use the movie. Because I always said that not only did we murder a victim in that scene, we murdered a song.
What made you choose those particular songs?
Well, because Annie, I actually don't mind the song of Annie. It's the kind of song that you can't get out of your head that drives you insane.
Mm-hmm.
And we would be in the editing room working on the scene, and later we'd be going, tomorrow. I think, oh, I don't believe I'm singing this song. And just the idea of being murdered while you're singing an optimistic song called Tomorrow added sort of a certain irony that appealed to me in this movie.
Now, I know you were raised Catholic.
Yes.
Went to Catholic school.
I just went to Catholic high school. I didn't go to Catholic grade school.
Okay.
So I'm only part brainwashed.
There's a very funny sermon in your movie, which I won't give away.
But it's not Catholic. That's an Episcopal church.
Okay.
I felt so mainstream.
Did you have favorite sermons from when you sermons that really stuck with you for their either for being moving or for being absurd?
Favorite is not a word I would think of. sermons, no, not so much. But I like to see how these days churches put out, they advertise their sermons on the marquee with these ludicrous kind of catchy things, and you can tell sometimes that the pastors think they're real funny, you know? And so I was trying to do a joke on that. You know, capital punishment and you, I think, is the sermon in the church I'm doing.
And I'm not putting all... I think some religious people do great things. They go out and help people that have problems. I just don't like religious people that judge other people. I have big problems with that. I like religious people that go out and help people that whose lives are terrible. I'm completely for that, as long as they don't preach pro-life like Mother Teresa, which made me change my opinion about her. I used to like her when she was just feeding poor people and minding her own business. But then when she starts telling them who to have sex with, I have problems.
Did you have to do any test screenings for Serial Mom?
Oh, sure. There's not a film in Hollywood today that has a budget of over $2 million that does not go through that lunatic process.
So what did you learn from the test screenings?
First couple test screenings were great. We learned what was too slow, if somebody was confused in one part, that kind of thing. I'm all for that. I'm against the cards. I'm against when they ask you to rate it good or very good. And then these focus groups sometimes, they all want to have talk shows. They're not virgin audiences anymore. They want to be witty. They want to crack a joke. They do sound bites. They don't do criticism.
Everybody wants to be a critic, huh?
Well, they don't even want to be a critic. They want to be I don't know. They want to have power of studio heads. And unfortunately, they do. I don't understand why they never would listen to some lunatic in a mall that they got at Sears comes in and suddenly every studio head stops and listens to what he says. Since when does he know one thing?
Did you have to make changes you didn't want to make?
No, I did not at all in this movie. I don't think you could ever see a Serial Mom and thought, well, boy, they made him do that. This film is exactly the film I wanted to make. I'm not saying there weren't discussions. I'm not just saying that. And it depends where we tested this movie. Some went great. Some went where people said, I feel guilty I like this movie, you see? And you can't, what's the test score on that? I'm glad they said they felt guilty when they liked it. That's the point of Serial Mom.
So are you ever amazed that you turned out to be a productive member of society?
No, because I always was productive. I mean, even at the height of the drug years and everything, I was making a movie a year. So, no, I was always productive. It just that was my product was rot-filled.
Rot-filled?
Rot-filled, yes.
Uh-huh. John Waters, his new movie is called Serial Mom. This is Fresh Air. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Linda, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Terry, we had a briefing at the Pentagon today on the incident in which two American fighter planes shot down two American helicopters over Iraq. We will also have an interview with the American trade ambassador on the occasion of the signing of the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, which took place in Marrakesh today. Brooke Gladstone reports on the Russian version of the softball game when the Democrats play the Republicans. This is the Duma's soccer match. Also, multimedia, more on multimedia from John McChesney, and a single media, the One Ring Circus.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. The fluke hit single of the season is Loser by the 23-year-old singer-songwriter Beck. After listening to his debut album, Mellow Gold, rock critic Ken Tucker decided Beck owes as much to rap as he does to folk.
The fact that the whiny phrase, I'm a loser, baby, so why don't you kill me, has become the catchiest thing on the radio is only our first measure of what an interesting oddball this kid Beck is. His full name is Beck Hansen. His lyrics sound as if he swallowed the Bob Dylan songbook, and he strums an acoustic guitar to a herky-jerky hip-hop beat. Last year, he was playing on Los Angeles street corners. His most requested number was a tune called MTV Makes Me Wanna Smoke Crack. Now he's signed to Geffen Records, and the video for Loser is in heavy rotation on MTV. This guy is some kind of slacker phenomenon.
She took me off my gun with disappointment. I got sucked inside of her apartment. She's got dried up flowers, flaky skin, a beaded necklace, and a bottle of gin. She's a nightmare hippie with the skinny fingers for the tragical beauty, self-conscious and a little bit moody.
The first time I listened to Mellow Gold, I was ready to dismiss Beck as a bad joke. The listless vocals, the glib surrealism of the lyrics, the lurching rhythm of the melodies, it was all so goofy, self-indulgent, and amateurish. But a few songs hooked me, and as I replayed the album, I began to hear the way the whole thing cohered as, well, as a shrewd commentary on what it's like to be goofy, self-indulgent, and amateurish.
How you like me now?
Pretty good.
Going on, feeling strong. I quit my job blowing leaves. Telephone bills up my sleeves. Choking like a one-man dust bowl. Freedom rock slime ball, talking in cold. We went down, lit up the shack. Grabbed me a beer out of the sack. Everybody been over twice. In the walls, throwing some dice, leaping up into the air, getting juiced up beyond belief. And they were singing like this. Why no throwing frisbees at the sun? Put my soul between a bum. Now I'm running, now I'm drunk. Now I'm running like a flaming pig. Scraping off the attitude. Old man eating all my food. Don't be kind, don't be rude. Just shake your boots and let it all get loose.
Beck is the latest version of a venerable tradition, the pop bohemian, who cultivates eccentricity and alienation in order to connect to as large an audience as possible. In Beck's case, he also has Generation X irony going for him. He's become a winner by proclaiming himself a loser.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for Entertainment Weekly. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Richard Parker, Joyce Lieberman, and Thad Kirk. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. Sue Spolin directed today's show. I'm Terry Gross.
So get out your lead pipe dreams. Get out your 10-foot flags. The insects are huge and the poison's all been used. And the drugs won't kill your day job. Honey, that's why I pay no mind. I pay no mind. I pay no
support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Backbeat, we talk with Ian Softley, co-writer and director of a new film about the early years of the Beatles, before they recorded, when the band included a fifth Beatle. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.